In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
Hello and welcome back to this special History Extra End of Roman Britain podcast series. This is episode 3 and I am David Musgrove, your host for the series. Last time I talked to Professor Will Bowden to get the background, what we know about late Roman Britain, the politics of its time and the conditions on the ground. This time we're going to turn our attention to the Roman army, on the assumption that one of the facets of the end of Roman Britain was the withdrawal of Roman legions. Our guide today is Dr. Rob Collins, lecturer in archaeology at the University of Newcastle, an expert on the Roman military and specifically on that most famous of Roman defensive boundaries, Hadrian's Wall. The first thing I asked him to do was to give us a top-line summary of his position on what happened at the end of Roman Britain. So, over to Rob.
For me, the end of Roman Britain actually is not one straight story. It's a series of a whole bunch of different stories that really depends on where you lived in Roman Britain when it comes to an end. So I'm sitting up here on Hadrian's Wall, and the end of Roman Britain is something that's happening, in my mind, very largely to the south. So it's not to say the end of Roman Britain doesn't affect all of Britain. It absolutely does. But the effects of that end are felt very differently. And so if you want a simple comparison, simple analogy, I kind of see the end of Roman Britain as a little bit like a BBC winter weather report, in which all of the UK has experienced some sort of snowfall. In the south, there's been maybe 3 or 4 centimeters of snow that have fallen. And then what you hear on the news is the RAF is launching helicopters to rescue people who are trapped on the M25. Trains have stopped. You know, babies are crying. How will people survive the cold? All this really massive hype. In the north of England, in the meantime, we've had 2 feet of snowfall and everything is normal. And that's kind of how I see the end of Roman Britain in that sense, that there's a lot more hype for it, I think, in the south of Britain than there is in the north.
Let's just take a quick pause there, because what Rob's just said is a reminder of what Will told us in the last episode about the complicated regional nature of the response to the decline in Roman influence. I thought it'd be useful to ask Rob to expand on that point a little bit more.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's fascinating is that, you know, we're so used to thinking of Britain as one unit, or maybe we think of it as the United Kingdom in the, you know, the combination of Scotland and Wales, Northern Ireland and England. But for Roman Britain, it's not actually a province anymore. In the Roman government, in the structure of Roman government, it's a diocese. It's kind of one entity, but at the next level up from province, there's actually four and maybe even five provinces that make up Roman Britain. And each province has its own governor, has its own governor's offices, its own tax collectors, its own separate government. And so you can't really think of Roman Britain as one unit. It's at least four different political units. And on top of that, you then have this really interesting situation where the late Roman Empire has separated its civilian or civic offices of governors, for example, or town councillors, from its military branch, from the generals in the army. And if you embark on a military career path, you will not fulfill a civilian governmental career path, and vice versa. If you're in the civil government, then you won't be part of the army. And it's actually meant to be a separation of powers in that sense. But in that regard, the north of Britannia, most of what we now consider northern England, from kind of Doncaster north, is controlled, not controlled, but you've got one general, the Dux Britanniarum, who's in charge of all the soldiers in northern England. And there, that might also be the same territory that's one province, Britannia Secunda, who also has a governor. However, they're two separate commands. And so that's the thing to think about, late Roman Britain, before it even all comes crashing down to an end or petering out and changing into something different. It's not really all one unit. It's not all the same.
It seems like a good moment for a pause here, because Rob just dropped in the question there of whether the Roman Empire came crashing down in Britain, or rather petered out. Now, we talked about the year 410 in the last episode, but just how significant was that? You'll remember how Will pointed out that what we can see in the archaeological record does start to change quite rapidly in the early years of the 5th century. So I wanted to clarify with Rob if he felt there was indeed a moment when Roman Britain ends.
Yes and no. In fact, it is tricky, because there's this fascinating series of events that starts happening, it's argued, on New Year's Eve of AD 406, when you get a barbarian invasion across the Rhine. And part of Britain's connection to the rest of the Roman Empire is really very much reliant upon that link. You know, really, it's the English Channel. It's Dover to Calais in some cases. And so the people in Britain, or at least the people in charge in Britain, are really worried that they're going to be cut off from the Roman Empire with this barbarian invasion. And so what happens is you get this quickly appointed local emperor who is meant to be an emperor for Britain and represent Britain's interests in the Roman Empire, who is supposed to solve this problem. The first one doesn't do so well, and he, I believe, he's removed. The second one also doesn't do what's expected, and I think he dies. The third one is appointed, and this is a man named Constantine. And what you have to remember is that 100 years earlier, Constantine the Great, as it were, was initially proclaimed emperor in Britain. So about 100 years after, Constantine the Great becomes the most popular and successful Roman emperor that anyone can imagine in living history. You know, we have a new emperor, Constantine, who's known as Constantine III. He crosses to Gaul with an army, and actually he's quite successful for a few years. But it's when he loses, or rather his government loses. What we have from one source, we interpret as there's a rebellion against Constantine III's government, where they oust his officials. And really, it's that appointment of Constantine III and then the rebellion against him that is kind of the political moment, the end of Roman Britain, because there's never any new Roman officials appointed, none that come from the continent, none that are proclaimed or at least recognized in our written sources. And so we can look at that period of AD 410, which is when we think this rebellion against Constantine III occurs, is the end of Roman Britain, because suddenly according to the very thin source material we have, the very few historical texts, there's no officially recognized Roman officials appointed or in government. So we can say, actually, there is an end to Roman Britain in a political sense. But the other question, the flip side, is politics isn't the same as culture. And so while there might not necessarily be an agreement about who's in charge in Roman Britain, that doesn't mean that all those things that made the life of those people in Roman Britain what it was, that's not going to just disappear overnight.
This feels like another good moment for a bit of a pause. So we've talked a bit about the nature of the late Roman state there and the place of the military within it. But that begs the really big question of how far was late Roman Britain a militarized state?
Roman Britain is always, to a large extent, a very militarized part of the Roman Empire. And also, it, very much in the outer periphery of the Roman Empire. If in the second century, it was an exciting place to be in Britain, a really good place if you were someone with ambitious career plans, getting an appointment to Britain was excellent. By the fourth century, getting an appointment to Britain isn't the sort of thing that you would brag about to your mates who are getting appointed to other provinces. It's considered a bit of a backwater. And in fact, there's even a Latin poem that is about Bonus the Briton, and it's a play on words, bonus meaning good. You know, effectively, how can a Briton be good? You know, the implication being that Britons are semi-barbarous at the best. So, you know, amongst the wider Roman Empire, Britain is seen as perhaps not as civilized a land as modern Britain thinks of itself. So because of that, late Roman Britain is actually almost surrounded to some extent by enemies, in that north of Hadrian's Wall, there certainly will be people probably living close to Hadrian's Wall who are a bit friendly or on good diplomatic terms with the Romans. But you've got this new enemy called the Picts. And the Romans talk about the Picts as pretty much being anyone north of the wall. Archaeologically, there's been some fantastic work. And we think in archaeological terms that the Picts are really in Highland Scotland. But for the Romans, the Picts were anyone north of the wall. And so we know that there are peoples, the Picts, that are raiding, attacking from north of the wall, not just over land, but ostensibly also by boat down the coasts on the east and west side of the country. There's also the Scotti, who at this point actually are not Scottish; they're the Irish. You know, it's a term a term for a raider from Ireland. So we've got the Scotti, but Irish raiders that are attacking the west coast of Britain, not just in the north, but also Wales and in the southwest as well. And then on the east coast and the southeast, since the later third century, there are accounts of Germanic pirates, of Saxons particularly, but also Franks and other Germanic peoples who are attacking the coasts. And so from pretty much every direction except the south, Britain could expect to be attacked. Now, these aren't massive, gigantic armies, invading hordes of barbarians. They're smaller attacks, they're raiding parties. But those raiding parties can still have quite an impact. You know, they can steal cattle, they can steal people, they can steal what wealth people possess, they can be burning crops. It doesn't take a lot, really, to disrupt a farmer's lifestyle and their ability to pay taxes. And if that's happening on a fairly regular basis every year, there's a challenge there. So the job of the Roman army was to defend the province. And so to that extent, you have the Dux Britanniarum in the north, who was in charge of all the soldiers in northern England, including Hadrian's Wall. You had in the southeast a position known as Comes Litoris Saxonici, the Count of the Saxon Shore. And his job was to man in effectively be a general of those garrisons, those forts along the southern eastern coast of England. So at Dover, at Richborough, at Pevensey. We also know that there's some forts in Wales, but we don't know if there's a different general in charge of those. That's evidence we don't have. But we do know that there's anywhere between, let's say, 12,000 and 20,000 soldiers in Roman Britain. It kind of around the time of AD 400. So that's a lot of soldiers. You know, there's at least two generals, and that defense of Britain is seen as important. There's enough pressures on the Roman Empire. If they If they didn't think Britain needed to be defended, they would put those soldiers elsewhere. So there is a sense that there needs to be some level of security, even if not from an invading army, at least from very pesky raiders.
So are you saying that Roman Britain was more heavily militarized than other parts of the Roman Empire, other than Gaul across the sea, for instance? Was there less of a proportion of soldiers to civilians, do we know?
Yes, absolutely. I think if you look at the proportion of soldiers to civilians, Britain is higher than average. But it's very shifty in dynamic across the Roman Empire. So the majority of soldiers are always kind of found in the frontiers. So stretched all along the Rhine, all along the Danube, and at key cities in the Near East and in Africa, you have kind of these soldiers. But there are other parts of the Roman Empire which have very, very few soldiers. So much of Roman Gaul actually didn't have that many soldiers. Most of the Iberian Peninsula, what's now Spain and Portugal, didn't really have many soldiers. Most of North Africa, in fact, didn't have many soldiers. And those are often known as the kind of the wealthy, rich parts of empire. And soldiers are usually found in the frontier. It's just the fact that Britain is a smaller unit than Roman Gaul or Roman Hispania, and that you've got three fronts, as it were, you know, north, east, and west, means that, you know, three out of those four sides of Britain have a greater military presence.
You've mentioned Hadrian's Wall a couple of times. It's a particular specialism of yours, and we've talked about it on the podcast before. But just a reminder, so in the year AD 400s, was Hadrian's Wall a functioning border, a functioning military border?
Yeah, so our evidence from Hadrian's Wall around AD 400 is that all the forts appear to be occupied. They're not evenly excavated in terms of evidence, but, you know, what evidence we have, it does look that, you know, every fort is still holding a garrison. We have evidence from some Mile castles in the form of pottery that, you know, that those Mile castles are still being garrisoned. You know, a lot of the forts to the south of Hadrian's Wall that make up that deep network of you know, military installations of a regional army are also occupied. We can see, you know, some of the latest fashions in terms of Roman military metalwork are also still around. So Hadrian's Wall and the army along it is still part of the Roman army in general. It's still participating in that empire-wide defense. So it's not something which has been given up. What we think is that there might be fewer soldiers around AD 400 than there was around AD 200. But actually, that's also a trend that we see across the entire Roman Empire, that Roman army units, on the whole, get a bit smaller. So there are probably fewer soldiers per fort, but they're still there. They're still doing their job. And what's also important to say that these are still paid soldiers. These are still professional soldiers. You know, they're not always paid completely in cash. You know, some of their payment is actually in terms of food and shelter and equipment. But it's still a professional salaried position and not just a hobby, for example.
And what do we know about these soldiers? Were they locally recruited or were they from across the entirety of the empire?
This is one of our real challenges in late Roman Britain. We can say so much about soldiers around AD 200. We have lots of inscriptions. We don't really have that practice of inscription anymore around AD 400. That habit to, you know, to carve a dedication on a new building or to carve a tombstone is really, it's very absent throughout the entirety of late Roman Britain. So we don't have the names of some of these individuals. We also, sadly, don't really have a lot of records or paperwork. The evidence that we get from something like the Vindolanda tablets, which is so rich in detail and vibrant in kind of daily activity. Those Vindolanda tablets are from the late first century, early second century AD, and have survived because of the depth at which they were buried. One of the things that you have to kind of understand with late Roman Britain is it's an archaeological issue around stratigraphy. And very simply put, late Roman Britain is higher in the soil. It's closer to the surface of the soil than early Roman Britain. And actually, that means our evidence for late Roman Britain is more vulnerable. It's more likely to have been destroyed by a plow. It's more likely to be bulldozed off, you know, when a new city building is put up. It was much more likely to be destroyed and damaged when a new castle was built in the Middle Ages. And so we just don't have a lot of that evidence. So in terms of who those soldiers are, I can't say with certainty. But what we can say, looking more broadly at the rest of the Roman Empire, is that most of those soldiers were probably local. They were probably men who, as children, were raised locally, if not immediately at the fort, then certainly within Northern Britannia. There would have been some men who are still posted from abroad. We know, for example, in the 370s that a whole load of Germanic barbarians were settled in Britain and were probably distributed throughout the frontier. So there would be some people who are foreign. It's not to say there's no mobility and travel, but the majority of those soldiers are probably, you know, local men.
So that leads on to an interesting question as to whether, and you talked about the external threats that Roman Britannia was facing, and in your one of your earliest answers, you talked about sort of internal rebellions and people. So were there internal threats that these soldiers were positioned to put down, and if so, if they were part of the local populace, how was that seen?
Yeah, the late Roman Empire is, I think it's fair to say, a state of paranoid politicians, that people were always looking after their own backsides, those people in power, and were aware of those internal threats. And so you have, throughout the late Roman Empire, there's very regular rebellions. And so there is that danger that there might be a rebel. It might be a governor who's gone rogue and wants his own kingdom. It might be actually someone who's just being corrupt, in our terms, that they are skimming off the money from taxes or skimming off the selling supplies that are supposed to go to the soldiers to line their own pockets. This sort of practice was actually quite common throughout the Roman Empire. And so there is that problem with internal security. There's also the emperor maintained something called agentes in rebus, secret agents, effectively. And so there was a secret police that also operated throughout the Roman Empire that would report on individuals. And so that was something else to be aware of. You know, even if you were an honest, upright sort of officer, if maybe you didn't play the game well, you could find yourself caught in a political intrigue and off with your head sort of thing.
Should we imagine then that aside from the actual professional soldiers that we've talked about, the civilian population were also potentially often armed and militarily minded, if that's not a strange way to describe it?
Not at all. There's an intriguing practice, actually, that we tend to think of the Romans as only having Roman soldiers. But actually, many of the wealthy, the well-to-do, the well-heeled, retained a private security force, effectively. They had armed retainers. And they were effectively a family bodyguard and a security force for their estates. So whether it's out on their villas in the countryside or their fancy townhouses, you know, inside the city walls, these important, inevitably mostly men, would be using their wealth to pay for private security forces. You know, we might think of them today as mercenaries, but it wasn't anything unique to Britain. It's found across the whole empire. And so that means there are armed civilians out there as well, and not just the soldiers.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So let's pause again. Rob's given us a good overview there of how far late Roman Britain was a militarized state and who the soldiers stationed here were supposed to be defending against. Now, incidentally, if you're interested in knowing more about the Picts, as he talks about, we have an entire podcast episode about them in our Everything You Want to Know series. Just search the podcast catalogue to find that. But a key question here is, can we see any evidence of these Roman soldiers actually upping sticks and leaving Britain at the start of the 5th century?
Actually, there is a very traditional notion, but one that's still deeply entrenched, that the Romans march away, that all the soldiers are withdrawn, and that marks the end of Roman Britain. That, you know, the absence of Roman soldiers is what confirms Roman Britain has come to an end. That's very much in contrast to our archaeological evidence. There's a number of military sites, fort sites, not least along Hadrian's Wall, but also not exclusive to Hadrian's Wall. We can see evidence of this along the Saxon shore in the south as well, that soldiers are remaining in place. What becomes really difficult for us is that question of how many soldiers are remaining in place. And one of the things I think that is unknowable at present is if you have those generals I talked about, if you have the Dux Britanniarum, if you have the Count of the Saxon Shore, if there's someone in that office doing the job, making sure that soldiers are getting their supplies, redistributing those supplies as necessary, enforcing recruitment to make sure that, you know, if soldiers die or retire, they're being replaced, then in principle, those armies can be retained. In practice, they probably slowly did wither and die. But we also think that the current thinking at the moment is something called the warband model. That even if those generalships are declining or disappearing, that actually the fact that many of those soldiers are local lads, you know, they're serving in the home they've always known, then they're not just upping sticks and leaving because that's what they're supposed to do. They're going to defend their home. That's their life. It's where they've lived. And so there's this notion that a lot of those soldiers will have become, you know, for lack of a better word, warriors in a local warband. And they won't be as, those warbands won't be as large as a Roman army unit. You know, it might go from being, say, 200 to 300 men to something like, you know, 30 or 40 men. But actually, in the 5th century, having an armed body of you know, 30 or 40 men is quite considerable and expensive as well.
And the scenario you've just described is a bunch of military men occupying Roman fortifications, looking like Roman legionaries, but not necessarily in the same political or even mental mindset of Romanitas. Is that correct? And how would you, is that archaeologically attested?
Yes, that's correct. So yeah, you have to think. Yeah, these are men. And what we don't know is if they call themselves Roman soldiers or not. But yeah, these are men who probably for multiple generations of their family have been Roman soldiers. You know, this is, it's not just their life; it's their entire, you know, family line's life and story. So they're just going to staying there, and we do have that archaeologically attested. There's the site of Burd Oswald on Hadrian's Wall, for example, which was excavated by Tony Wilmot in the late 80s and early 90s. And he found this really incredible sequence of change, of transformation, that the large granary buildings, the kind of the big warehouses that are meant to supply a Roman garrison. The building itself is still erect, but it's no longer being used as a warehouse. What he found was evidence for a new floor surface. He found a hearth at one end, you know, a fire that people are sitting around. And beside that fire, he found a golden earring, you know, which suggests that you have someone relatively wealthy sitting there. We assume a woman because it's an earring, but it's feasible it could be a man as well. But you have an important person that's sitting at that fireplace. And that former granary has now become something much more like a village hall. And that's only the first of a sequence of three. The roof on that village hall, former granary, collapses. They build a new one overlying the granary that was to the north. And when that one collapses, they build a new one. And so you have here three village halls, or actually, archaeologically, they look like feast halls or mead halls that we associate with the Anglo-Saxons. But they're not built by Anglo-Saxon immigrants. They're not built in the south or east of England, where we have that Anglo-Saxon migration. They're built in a fort on Hadrian's Wall with no other sense of this new migration. So this is just part of that transformation of soldiers being part of a Roman army that connected across the entire Roman Empire to being part of a local military force.
And that archaeological story that you just talked about, based on excavation in the halves and that sort of thing, does that agree or disagree with the historical evidence that we have, do you think?
That disagrees with the historical evidence. And that's largely because we really don't have a lot of historical evidence for the end of Roman Britain. The few sources we have that are broadly contemporary are from Gaul. And I think that's the other thing we have to bear in mind, that those writers in Gaul, exciting and interesting as they are, they probably are also only writing about maybe the south of England. The north of England is far beyond their sight. And that, again, we're coming back to that sense of regionality of Roman Britain, that we can't take the evidence of one or two writers in Gaul to stand for all of Roman Britain. It might only stand for Kent or for Wessex, you know, those parts of Britain that were closest to Gaul. But it's a really important story to counter in looking, bringing in that archaeology. And so, you know, all those really fascinating finds that make us question, you know, how biased those ancient writers were is really important. And I think helps us better understand the realities of living in a post-imperial society.
So we've got a bit of a challenge here in that we've got archaeological evidence and historical evidence that are somewhat at odds. Rob's describing scenarios where people are still maintaining Roman sites, but perhaps without the integration into the Roman Empire and its economic and security networks. So we get this local warband model being proposed, a substantive change rather than a collapse in society, and not this old idea of a great withdrawal of troops to elsewhere. But again, Rob's stressing the regional complexities of the situations. Roman Britain was a place of many parts, but it seems like he's describing a place that was more dangerous and hostile generally. What I wanted to know from him is whether there's any evidence of violence in the archaeological record.
The evidence is really tentative, but there has been some work, for example, looking at skeletal material, which suggests that there is an increase in violence, more wounds and traces on skeletal material, on bones, that suggest, you know, violent activity. And that's just what we can see. There's a lot of ways that people can die that will leave no traces on bones. But there is that tentative evidence. I think the other thing to remember is that while the Roman Empire could be a very brutal system in a very brutal place, that there were some things that also brought a greater measure of peace. You know, there were laws that were enforced. When you lose that overarching authority, you know, there's no one there to enforce those laws. That introduces a lot more danger to the system, and that anyone with the strength to enforce their own will can do so. And so suddenly, if those villa owners or town councillors don't have an emperor they have to send their taxes to, and yet they've also got a private security force, their own security guards, they could very quickly become even more bullies, even greater bullies out in the countryside. On the other hand, maybe because they don't have to send their taxes off, maybe they don't have to be as big a bullies. You know, they can, you know, there's not as much pressure on them. So maybe there's a bit more food, to go around. It's tough to say, but you can really easily imagine if suddenly we, you know, if maybe not today for us, but, you know, in another 10 years when, say, our children have grown up and there's no parliament, there's no prime minister, you know, who's in charge? Who's keeping us safe? It becomes a really, potentially a scary thought.
And just thinking about taxation and finances and the broader economy. So you've talked about there being a lot of soldiers potentially in Britannia. I don't know if we can make an accurate estimate of the actual proportion of soldiers versus civilians, but presumably quite a lot, and therefore quite important financially. What are the economic impacts of those soldiers being less prevalent?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the key questions, really, that when you've got to pay for an army, soldiers are expensive. And whether that's soldiers that you're paying for out of your taxes for the state, or whether those are your own personal soldiers that you're paying for out of your private accounts and profit margins. There potentially is a better lifestyle to be had for the average farmer in Britain, because their tax burden has probably decreased. The Roman state was extremely greedy. And what the Roman state didn't get, usually the local oligarchs did. So in that sense, it may have been a better era for the average farmer. But it's also hard to build up something complex again. And I think that's the challenge that the new kind of emerging kingdoms of post-Roman Britain were facing. One of the benefits of the Roman Empire was really good infrastructure. There were roads. If you needed help, if you had a bad crop, if there was a drought or a blight, you could request assistance or food from someplace else. And when the empire starts fragmenting, there's fewer places you can turn to for help. You lose some of your backup or your safety net, I think is the way to think of it. And in some cases, paying for the Roman army is a bit of a safety net as well, because it keeps other people from coming and taking what you do have. So if soldiers aren't being paid, there's a good chance that the army will kind of wither away. But that's where we need to, I think, better understand the way the late Roman army works. And this is why it's important to know that soldiers weren't just paid in cash. They weren't waiting for a massive chest of coins to come from some distant city. Most of their pay was in food and in armament and equipment and shelter. And so that relationship between a commander and his soldiers was actually not that dissimilar to, say, a barbarian chief and his warriors, sitting north of Hadrian's Wall. And there's a sense of kind of loyalty there and kind of relying on that commander to look after you and your family. So it becomes a question of how much were other parts of Britain really supporting, the army and making it feasible.
So it's a case of allegiance to the man rather than allegiance to the construct there in the way that you describe it.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. Most soldiers, I'd say they vote with their feet, but they probably vote with their stomachs and their feet just kind of take them there. So, as long as you've got a commander who's looking after them, keeping them safe, keeping them equipped, keeping them fed, that's a reasonably good commander, especially in a time when you can't guarantee that someone else will provide those things. And so that's the trick, is keeping everyone fed.
Let's just take another quick moment of reflection, because we've talked a fair bit here about the importance of taking a regional or even a local view to try and understand what's happening across Britain as direct Roman influence wanes. And I think that's what you're going to hear from a lot of our other experts as we go through the series. But what we've not discussed much here about was what was happening to the north and west. So I asked Rob if he could talk a little bit about whether there was much population movement and change there.
It's harder to see a little bit in the north of England, but actually where we can see it really clearly is in Wales and the southwest. And there's that whole notion of Irish immigration. So we often think about, the end of Roman Britain as being the first part of the birth of Anglo-Saxon England. But actually what's being forgotten is a substantial amount of Irish migration onto the western parts of Britain. And so we can see inscribed stones with what's known as the Irish alphabet of Ogham that are testifying to Irish settlement. And that's particularly prominent in Wales, but particularly Dyfed in southwest Wales and in Cornwall. We have also the story of St. Patrick, who is kidnapped at some point in the earlier 5th century, from somewhere in the west of Britain. We don't know exactly where. I think everyone claims him as his own. Cumbria, Lancashire, Wales, you know, Cornwall. Everyone wants a bit of St. Patrick. But we know Patrick is stolen as a 16-year-old lad off the west coast of Britain and is a slave in Ireland for a number of years before he hears his calling. So we can see this movement. We have a written account, a very rare written account of a first-person account, an autobiography of being a slave and being taken from Britain to Ireland. And then we have this settlement in the other direction of the Irish coming and settling in Britain that we can see with Ughamstones particularly, which give us the names of some of these leaders at the time. So there very much is movement. It's still a very dynamic environment. And it's, you know, and we have that migration on the east coast of Britain as well. What's harder to see is in the north. There are some tales, however. One of the origins of the Welsh kingdom of Gwynedd is that they were founded by a prince of the Vodadini, which is a tribe which is thought to have been centered on Lothian in southeast Scotland, and that a prince of the Vodadini migrates to North Wales to kick out the Irish invaders and becomes a king there. And we can't prove that. It might just be a folktale. But again, it's providing a story, a migration folklore, as it were, that's connecting different parts of Britain.
Right. To summarize, and you can tell me if I'm putting words into your mouth, but it sounds to me as if what you're saying is you don't see necessarily a particular moment of direct, obvious collapse. There's political events which may or may not have been directly relevant to a loss of the population, but you are talking about a fifth century being more unstable, less secure, a movement of Roman troops to morph into something which is more akin to war bands, but not... And just tell me if I'm wrong, not some terrible dystopia where there is no rule of law at all and where everyone is in constant fear of their lives.
Yes, yeah, that's absolutely correct. So it's you know, if we compare the 5th century post-Roman Britain with the 4th century, there's a lot of change. There's a lot of uncertainty. I think absolutely we could see, as a consumer, you might have a lot less consumer choice. Some of those specialist craft workers might not be as readily available as they were for your grandfather. But it's not to say that every day is a struggle either. And I think the way I would pitch it is the scale of society shrinks, it fragments. Whereas late Roman Britain was part of a larger interconnected Roman Empire, the globalism of its era, even if there were regional interests and regional differences, there was a network in place there for politics, for economy, for scholarship. Fifth century Britain doesn't have that. It's not as well connected in the same way. That's not to say that all the ropes in the net were cut. You know, we can see international long distance travel, migration. We can see that there are still some economic links. You know, we still are seeing, you know, Roman gold coins of the 5th century that will find their way to Britain. But it's not at the same scale or the regularity that we saw previously. And so I suspect that you need kind of think of it as, you know, living your life with a much more zoomed in or restricted frame of reference. And availability of things.
I'm going to ask you to get poetic on me now. I imagine you spend a lot of time walking along Hadrian's Wall you know, enjoying the scenery there and the fantastic upstanding Roman remains. Do you ever wander along there and think, Carl, what must it have been like here in the 5th century? And what, if you do, what images are conjured up in your mind?
Yeah, actually, all the time. That's part of my job, you know, trying to work out what's happening along the wall in the 5th century. And I think, again, my question there is it depends where you're standing on Hadrian's Wall. If you're standing on the wall closer to the east coast at Newcastle or Wallsend or even the fort at South Shields, you know, you can see how those locations have been a bit more connected to the sea. Your concerns are maybe not going to be the same as the soldier who's at Housesteads or Vindolanda and is in the middle of the wall in a real upland sector that doesn't have any sea connections, whose supplies are coming from the east, you know, from Corbridge or from the west, from Carlisle. You know, if you know that there's not an emperor there or a general, a Dux Britanniarum, to make sure that your men get supplies, you might have some genuine concerns about, well, how will I feed my men if we have a bad summer? You know, is there enough food locally to provide that food for them? And so your alliances, your interests, your decisions might change very strongly based on where you are along the wall. And while I would love to think that those commanders of the wall all continue to cooperate and work together through the fifth century, the reality is many of them may have had to make some choices, that perhaps those barbarians to the north that were enemies maybe became new friends. And their former commanders or their former allies, the other commanders along the wall, maybe they became enemies, you know, people who they had to fight with for resource. And so that loss of empire means almost anything is up for grabs.
So that was Dr. Rob Collins of Newcastle University. He's written widely on the frontiers of the Roman Empire, particularly on the subject of Hadrian's Wall. You might like one of his more recent books, Living on the Edge of Empire, The Objects and People of Hadrian's Wall, which is published by Pen and Sword. And if you're a History Extra podcast enthusiast, which as I assume you are, as you've got this far with this series, you'll probably enjoy the Everything You Want to Know episode that I conducted with Rob about Hadrian's Wall. Just search through the catalogue for that. Next time round, we're talking about religion. So tune back in to find out about religion in late Roman Britain with Dr. David Petz.